Helen, I just wanted to touch on your previous role reviewing Australia's last pandemic drill. Were you surprised to learn that there hadn't been one since 2008?
Surprised is a very lovely understatement on your part, Ebony. I was gobsmacked, actually.
And welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. And at the time of recording this, on Tuesday the 21st of April 2020, The Guardian reports that Australia has 6,633 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and a tragic 71 deaths. But Australia is doing better than a lot of other countries, and at this point we've got more options available to us than many other countries have. But there's no doubt 2020 has been a pretty wild ride in Australia, because it was just a few months ago that we were in the grip of an unprecedented bushfire season, with whole communities engulfed in smoke, some sheltering on beaches to escape the flames, thanks to one of the hottest, driest years on record. And now, of course, we're facing an unprecedented threat from COVID-19. And trying to avoid the awful fate of Northern Italy, Spain, the UK and the United States, where the number of cases has overwhelmed the health system, leaving mass deaths and requiring mass graves. So, I don't know, if you're like me, everything feels pretty fragile at the moment, whether it's the economy, your personal health, or your ability to pay the bills. A sense of security is in pretty short supply.
They're under threat from six huge bushfires burning out of control right now around New South Wales and Canberra.
There's a desperate shortage of food, of water and just basic supplies along here. There is a naval ship that's due to arrive and help begin the mass evacuations of thousands of people.
Defence Force and AUSMAT personnel will reopen emergency rooms in Burnie today after two Tasmanian hospitals were closed following a COVID-19 outbreak.
With the twin battles that we face and that we fight, against a virus and against the economic ruin that it can threaten.
Who would have thought in 2020 that some states would choose to close their borders? Now, that was an issue that...
Hundreds of the newly unemployed lined up outside Centrelink. Images reminiscent of the Great Depression.
And it had a wartime feel to it, but it has to. It genuinely is war. What we do now, what we do fast, what we do well, will save a bunch of lives.
This week I wanted to talk to Alan Beam, the director of the Australia Institute's International and Security Affairs Program, about why he thinks we need to revisit the idea of national security and what it means. Now, Alan Beam has long experience in international policy, national security policy and defence policy. He was Greg Combe's chief of staff in the Rudd and Gillard governments, dealing with climate change, a really very serious strategic issue on its own. And more recently, he was Penny Wong's senior foreign policy advisor. He's also the inaugural chair of the Canberra Writers Festival and remains a board member of Fearless, a not-for-profit that addresses the needs of many Australians who live with PTSD. And actually, it was Alan who reviewed the exercise Sustain, the pandemic drill that we conducted back in 2008. He reviewed that for the government. So I'm very excited to talk to him today. G'day, Alan.
G'day, Ebony.
So to begin with, what do most people think of when you say national security, and why do we need to rethink it?
I think the majority of people, when you say national security, think about the military, they think about warships and tanks and jet fighters. I suppose quite a lot of people think also about things like ASIO, the security services. They think about spying and all of those sorts of things. They might think of subversion. But the reality is that national security is about the security of the citizens. And that's a much bigger concept than simply military or police security.
And why is it that you think we need to rethink this concept of national security? Why is now the right time to do that?
I think at the moment a lot of us are reasonably confused as to how it could be that so many of our citizens find themselves homeless between South Queensland and Kangaroo Island in South Australia, their houses burnt down, they have no economic security, their businesses are closed down, and as if that weren't bad enough, the arrival of the pandemic has effectively closed down the economy, so that we have rising 1 million Australians who are now unemployed and looking for government benefits to keep them afloat. That goes to the heart of the security of the citizen. So many of us, I think, are beginning to wonder whether the concentration on purely military means for protecting the well-being of our citizens is enough when, as I say, over 1 million of our citizens are now facing government subsidies in order to stay alive.
Yeah, the concept of national security seems a bit useless at the moment if it doesn't include those things.
Well, one can understand that coming out of a very long period of prosperity, all of us have become pretty complacent about the general state of our economy, and in a way we could afford to concentrate more narrowly on defence expenditure. But we've done that, I think, without really contemplating what it means to keep our citizens in a state of well-being and contentment, which, after all, is the whole purpose of living in a democratic society. So what I'm calling for is that we have a different starting point for national security. Instead of starting with the security of the state or the security of the nation and defending that against other states or other nations, I think our starting point should be how secure, how comfortable are our citizens. And I think that's where you start a discussion around the security of the nation.
So having a roof over your head and your health at the moment are two very basic forms of security that many people are missing out on. And as you said, not one's well addressed by our current, the way that we think about national security at the moment.
No.
Do you think that's only a result of prosperity? Are there any other reasons why we've kind of formed this quite narrow view of what national security means?
Well, I mean, partly, I guess, it's our history. We have always thought that the great threats to the security of Australia were the First War and the Second War. We got ourselves sort of voluntarily into Vietnam, which, with the benefit of hindsight, we think wasn't all that clever. And we've got ourselves voluntarily into both Iraq and Afghanistan, which we are beginning to see is also not so clever. So the mindset, I think, that we've been developing in Australia for over 100 years now is very much a military mindset in looking at the dynamics of national security. But I was struck by a remark that the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, made when he appeared on, I think it was Q&A just before Christmas last year, where he identified the bushfires as being a fundamental challenge to national security. And I think he was completely correct in that the bushfires, an artefact of climate change essentially, were already in December threatening the livelihoods of thousands of people in hundreds of communities in Australia in a way that no military conflict since 1945 has impacted on any Australian. And that is why I think we need to have a much broader understanding of what national security looks like when the real threats to people come from things that are not military or not kinetic, to use the language of the military, but the real threats are coming from things like pandemics, they're coming from climate, obviously, and they also come from the lack of controls over the spread of nuclear weapons. And they're things that are not amenable to military solutions.
And so if we're kind of removing this idea, or not removing, but adding to this idea that a military response is kind of the only way that we can respond to and ensure national security, what other things do we need to start encompassing in this idea when we're rethinking national security?
Yes. I think the real starting point is that every citizen has a right in our democracy to a life that is marked by contentment, happiness and well-being. So I think the starting point is that we ensure that there is a very, very strong social support network that allows people to be able to weather the storms that come by, whether it's a collapse of a business or whether it's external economic shocks or the force of floods or the force of hurricanes or even bushfires such as we had over the summer. So our starting point, I think, is having good social security networks, having extremely good health systems, having very strong education systems, good employment regimes where people can participate, that they've got good jobs to go to. I think they're all the sorts of things that you start to think about when you think about real national security. One of the questions, Ebony, that has been worrying me for some time is that it's a sort of a conundrum. Can you have a secure state if its citizens are not secure?
Mm.
And I don't think you can, because your citizens, if they're not secure, are not going to want to support the interests of the state because they haven't got the emotional or physical or economic wherewithal to do so.
Well, the thing that makes me think of, Alan, is actually the economy that we have at the moment with so many people in casual, insecure and gig work, and the kinds of problems that we're seeing in states without very good social safety nets, where in the middle of a pandemic, people like that are forced to go to work, even if that's a threat to their own health or to others, simply to make ends meet. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yes, I think that represents a direct attack on the security of the individual, to be quite candid. And as one reflects on some of the more interesting parts of how we're handling the current pandemic, for instance, the problems with the hospitals in northern Tasmania, I mean, we might look at that and say, well, that's a problem for Tasmania. But actually, what it represents is decades of underinvestment in the health support system, which is necessary for all of our citizens. Everybody in Tasmania, in the Northern Territory and elsewhere, we all have the right to a fair standard of basic health support. And that, it would appear to me, is not properly in place in Northern Tasmania.
Mm.
So whether it's health support in Northern Tasmania or the ability to recreate strong economic infrastructures between the Queensland border and the Victorian border, just along coastal New South Wales, they're the things I think that deeply preoccupy lots of people at the moment, and they have every right to demand a much better set of answers.
You talked about four things that you would change in the article that you wrote for The Guardian. Firstly, the relationship between the citizen and the state needs to be redefined. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. The way in which, I mean, I have a background, a very long background in national defence planning. And I can say with some authority, I think, that the starting point for that is never the security of the individual Australian citizen.
Mm.
The starting point for that is always the security of Australia, that is the continent of Australia, with everything that represents, essentially focused on the maintenance of a governmental system against external attack. Now, that, of course, is what you seek to do from a military point of view. But I don't think that the defence of Australia against military attack is coterminous with national security, because you can't defend Australia against an external attack unless you have the full-throated support of all of the citizens of Australia in that endeavour. And you can only have that where you have citizens that are fully aligned with the idea of being an Australian and defending what being an Australian means. And I think you define that in terms of having a roof over your head, having a job to go to, having a good sense that when you are on your way home, you're going to get home, that when you get home, the water will be clean, that you're going to have food in the house to eat. That's the fundamental starting point of any concept of security. And it has been ever since the word security was invented back in Roman times. The starting point for Cicero was a contented person.
Secondly, you talked about the need to move away from the reactive planning dynamic that focuses more on threats and risk and to being more proactive and building things like harmony. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I mean, our default position in planning, particularly in short to middle term planning, is to have the capacity to react to things that we didn't expect. Now, obviously, things do happen that you don't anticipate are going to happen, but you can anticipate that from time to time there will be floods, that from time to time there will be fires, that from time to time there will be very strong winds that are going to blow branches off trees. So you make adequate preparations in advance so that your ability to react is not limited by your inability to plan and to think ahead. People like to say, well, the pandemic that we're facing at the moment is a black swan event. In other words, it's a total surprise. It's not a total surprise. We've known for well over 100 years that pandemics can arise and that you have to be well prepared in advance to deal with them. Otherwise, your economy will shatter, your communities will shatter, and the people who live in those communities will either die or look forward to a standard of living which takes them back to where you might have been 50, 60, 100 years ago. So the reactive mode of planning, I think, is inadequate. What you need to do is to put in place all of the infrastructural capacities that allow you then to react efficiently, quickly, and with great effect. So you don't exclude the ability to react, but you deal with problems by thinking about them before they occur. That's what I mean by proactive planning.
And you also talked about the idea of harmony, inclusion, resilience and tranquility being important things to have in place so that threats are, I think you said, not things to be defeated but things to be prevented.
That's exactly right. That and these are not binaries. I mean, defeating things and preventing things, that's not a binary. That's simply part of a system. So the starting point is that you've got to have a really strong and able system, which is agile and flexible, before you're able to do anything at all. And in the extended social system in which we're privileged to live in this country, it really builds itself around concepts of fairness, of equality, of inclusion, of harmony, of compassion. These are the things that really define a strong, resilient modern society. And if you've got one of those, then you can handle almost anything. It's probably hard to handle an asteroid that comes out of deep space, but almost anything else that is human-induced, and I include climate and nuclear weapons in that, any of those things you can handle if you've got a strong and resilient and functioning society.
I guess we can call Bruce Willis if an asteroid's heading towards Earth and take care of the rest ourselves. But thirdly, you kind of talked about this idea of needing to replace a control mindset with an empowerment approach. Can you unpack that a little bit for me?
I think that that is really central to the way in which we handle any domestic issue in Australia. I've been a bit concerned, for instance, during the enforcement, and I am using the word enforcement, of social distancing rules in some of our states in Australia, that our law enforcement agencies are looking at a coercive approach to it rather than a much more encouragement or empowerment approach to dealing with issues just as simple as social distancing. So, for instance, in the Australian Capital Territory, where I live, the police have been quite vigilant on social distancing, But the approach that they've applied here has been to go and talk to people and to suggest to them that it might actually be better that they go home or that they walk 2 metres apart and just bear in mind that if they do that, they're protecting everybody else as well as themselves. Whereas the idea that a guy who buys a kebab sits on a park bench and gets a $1,500 fine, that really doesn't sit well with a society which is inclusive, empowered, and all of the things that I said before. So I think that while you do necessarily have to enforce the law, there are bad people around, your starting point should be to encourage people to see what the law is for, to comply with it voluntarily because they see it as being in their own interests, rather than doing it because they're going to get a stiff fine or a jail sentence.
So less enforcement and more encouragement.
That's exactly right.
Lastly, I just wanted to ask you about your fourth point in the article in The Guardian, which was that it's important that the intervention model of public policy is tempered by a prevention model that emphasises what you can do to put a stitch in time rather than, you know, requiring a massive response to something down the track. What's the virtue of that kind of approach?
That's right. It's about how you have a mindset which is adaptable and able to deal with the issues that crop up. Now, you do have to prevent things. That goes without saying. But one of the exercises in prevention that has fascinated me for the best part of 30 years now is the really remarkable work that Professor Fiona Stanley did all those years ago on what she called early childhood intervention, which was to ensure that newborn babies and toddlers and young kids would have proper nutrition and proper social circumstances to live in so that as they went into school and then went on through their adolescence, they could become properly contributing elements of our society. Now, that was particularly focused on Indigenous communities where the issue around single mums and a lack of funding and money and so on was impacting dreadfully on the nutrition of young children. And it's well known that behavioural difficulties in adolescence can often be encouraged by poor nutrition in childhood. And so Professor Stanley worked out that if we were to make that kind of intervention early, then we would be preventing high incarceration rates much further down the track. So that the objective of her early intervention was long-term prevention. And I think that that is a really sound mindset with respect to all aspects of national security. Yes, you do have to act sometimes in your own interest and sometimes you've got to defend. But if you're clever, you should be able to forestall all of those circumstances by having really good prevention models which make intervention much less necessary through the lifetime of a given community or nation.
And finally, Alan, I just wanted to touch on your previous role reviewing Australia's last pandemic drill. Were you surprised to learn that there hadn't been one since 2008?
Surprised is a very lovely understatement on your part, Ebony. I was gobsmacked, actually, because one of my recommendations in 2008 had been that we should exercise the national pandemic response at least every 2 years. Now, there are sound reasons for that. In one of those national exercises, you're not really testing how good the doctors are or how good the paramedics are, how good the nurses are. You're not testing whether the fire brigade works. You're not testing the conceptual policy skills of your public servants. What you're really testing is the ability of decision makers to make complex decisions in circumstances where the problems are, in that sort of proper sense, wicked. That is, they're problems that are multifactorial, multidimensional, they're disconnected, they all come at once, and you have to have some way of sorting through them to get the best result for the community. That's what the exercises are for. We haven't done that for 12 years, and it comes then to me as a little surprise that the initial steps of
both the Commonwealth and the state governments were tentative, confused, they were acting at cross purposes, it was every man for himself, a bit of dog eat dog. All of that is prevented when you have proper practices in advance. You will always have terrible problems on the day, but the best way to minimise the effect of those problems on the day is to have thought about them, rehearsed them, and have a good sense of the complexity of the systems that you've got to operate within. And as I say, I was really, really surprised to find out that we hadn't had such an exercise in 12 years.
Well, thank you, Alan.
It's been a pleasure, Eb.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic. So please stay tuned and stay subscribed. You can check out the Australian Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website. And the next event is on Wednesday, the 22nd of April at 11 a.m. And it's on the crisis facing the media industry with special guest Kim Williams, Chair of Thomson Reuters Trustees and former CEO of News Corp Australia, the Australian Film Commission and Musica Viva, the Walkley Award-winning journalist, author and broadcaster Quentin Dempster, and of course our Chief Economist Richard Dennis. It's free, but registration is essential, so check out our website at tai.org.au to register. For the latest health information, please check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 21st of April, 2020, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit tai.org.au for all of our latest research and content. And please check out Alan's excellent article on rethinking national security in the comment section of The Guardian. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and Alan is at Miranda Prosus. That's PROSUS. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with help from Hayley Wilkinson and Hamish Cole. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.